Welcome to Farmer Talk Radio. This podcast is focused on unlocking the potential of ctDNA for prognostic stratification, tumor evolution insights, and accelerated drug development from the 2024 Immuno-Oncology 360 Conference. For more information on the IO 360 Conference, editorial, podcast, or webcast, you can visit io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thank you and enjoy the podcast.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming to our panel discussion focused on circulating tumor DNA. This continues to be a very hot topic given its demonstrated benefits and potential impact on patient care and the therapeutic development process. There are a number of contexts of use for ctDNA, some of which with utility established. For example, the use of ctDNA for enrolling patients into clinical trials and subsequently for selection of treatments for patients in a clinical setting. And of course, this brings with it companion diagnostic applications, which is a very high bar to clear for any technology platform. There are, of course, other applications that are still in development, perhaps are a bit aspirational, that might include the use of ctDNA as an early endpoint to support accelerated approvals in the solid tumor space, or for the development of de-escalation protocols to avoid unnecessary treatment burden to patients. So ctDNA technologies and associated scientific and clinical innovation, of course, holds great promise, and it's my pleasure and honor to moderate this discussion today. We'll start with some foundational questions, technical and regulatory around ctDNA space. Of course, we'll move into clinical applications as well. So again, my name is Matt Silver. I'm the head of oncology, precision medicine, and companion diagnostics at Takeda, joined by three esteemed colleagues up here that we'll introduce in just one moment. But wanted to thank Kate and the conference organizers for the opportunity to discuss this topic and for putting ctDNA on the agenda. It's really great. All right, so to get started, I wanted to begin with a bit of a round-robin style. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to introduce yourselves. And in doing so, please comment a bit on how you're working with ctDNA, how you're engaged in ctDNA, just to create that context. There's a lot of dimensions within this space, so I think that frame is helpful for everyone to understand. And if you wouldn't mind also saying a few words at a high level of what excites you about ctDNA. And maybe we can start at the end with John.
John Simmons, head of biopharma at
Takeda.
Are you hearing me? Nope. Oh, how about now? Okay. John Simmons, head of biopharma at Natera. And at Natera, we specifically work with molecular residual disease assays, which is called Signatera. It's a tumor-informed assay, predominantly used in the solid tumor space, where we are looking generally in the earlier stage cancers, in the adjuvant setting often, to determine after curative intent surgery, does a patient need more therapy, or even after that standard of care therapy, does that patient still have molecular tumor burden that requires additional treatment? Our assay is also used for molecular response monitoring to give insights into drug development and also determine, you know, if therapy switch might be necessary. I would say the thing that excites me with ctDNA at this sort of intersection in time is in the adjuvant setting in particular. We know traditionally we've either over-treated an awful lot of patients or under-treated a minority of patients, but still with a goal of cure. And I think now we're getting to the time that the technology is enabling us to identify those patients who need more therapy and spare the rest of the patients from either being overtreated or those patients who need more therapy from being undertreated. So the potential for cure, I think, is the thing that's still exciting for me.
Reshma. Hi, I'm Reshma Patel from Johnson & Johnson Innovative Medicine. I work in global regulatory affairs, and actually I work in the heme space rather than the solid space. So from my perspective, it's more around MRD in the heme space. And I think this is where we have probably more advanced development in the myeloma space, going into AML, and hopefully into the lymphoma space. But what excites me about MRD is the potential of whether this can be used as an early clinical endpoint for registration, and potentially novel assets, novel drugs getting to patients much, much earlier. So rather than waiting for PFS or OS, these novel agents getting to the patients much, much earlier.
Hi, my name is Jeff Allen. I'm the president and CEO of an organization called Friends of Cancer Research. It's a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. Our involvement in the ctDNA space has been over the last several months participating and running a collaboration aiming to aggregate data across numerous clinical development programs in order to do meta-analytical studies around the correlation of ctDNA change and long-term outcomes. And our goal is to take steps toward some of the things that Reshma described around the utilization of ctDNA change as a potential clinical trial endpoint that can be measured earlier. And I think that coincides with, I don't know if excitement's the right word, but at least my sense of urgency in terms of doing this, because I think it's important that we keep in mind that while conferences like this are wonderful at highlighting the advancements that have been made, a vast majority of cancers still represent an unmet medical need, and finding ways to accelerate the process of developing and delivering new treatments continues to be an ongoing challenge. And I think we have a real potential here, given the advancements on a technological and molecular level, to be able to identify new treatments sooner and move through that process hopefully faster than has been historically possible.
Thank you. And I guess just to round out that section, for me personally, I'm interested in all aspects of ctDNA, but two in particular that have really caught my attention is, first, use of ctDNA for patient enrollment in clinical trials, as I mentioned just a moment ago, but at the same time, or more recently, developed quite an interest in the use of ctDNA-based molecular response to help guide internal decision-making early in clinical development. And I know that's a topic that has come up quite a bit here, and we'll circle back to that in a few minutes with a couple of questions on that front for you guys. So to kick us off, and to set the stage, I wanted to start with a foundational question. We'll send it down to you, John. And can you share your insights into the sort of general benefits and challenges associated with ctDNA testing and touch on some of the technological considerations that are in play? Because I know that's a very complicated space. There's a lot of different ways to assess ctDNA. I was wondering if you could walk us through a couple thoughts there.
Sure. So when we think about ctDNA, especially in the solid tumor space, maybe separated into two bits, you have one application where you were essentially genotyping patients, and I think that was the hot topic of the 2010s. Previously worked on that side of the business as well. So you're using peripheral blood, identifying specific tumor biomarkers, EGFR, KRAS, et cetera, to specifically guide a match to a targeted drug. I think what we at Natera, and I think a lot of the excitement we're discussing here, is on the molecular residual disease front. And so in that case, really what you see are most often in solid tumors, tumor-informed approaches like we use at Natera. So what that really means is we take a tumor biopsy, so we're actually looking at the tumor tissue, performing whole exome sequencing or some sort of sequencing on that tumor, identifying bona fide somatic mutations, and then following those mutations in the patient's peripheral blood. What that allows us to do is to make an efficient assay that can be used multiple times throughout that patient's treatment journey with exquisitely high sensitivity. So if you cast too big of a net in plasma, you're paying for a lot of sequencing. So you want to be really zoomed in on specific mutations to follow that patient's plasma. So that's a caveat for clinical trial design for using a test like ours, is that you need tissue from some point in that patient's journey, but then you have that opportunity to follow that patient throughout their journey. Other approaches have used tissue non-informed sorts of approaches. Those to date, I think there's a lot of excitement there. I think that technology is a little bit more emergent. And we have efforts internally at Natera, and there's other efforts that are out there. We've seen some of those trials actually have rather confounded results because of specificity issues. We're looking for a very, very small amount of tumor material in the patient's blood. We're talking about single-digit amounts of molecules of circulating tumor DNA in in two tubes of blood. So you really have to hone in on sensitivity, but also specificity, because these tests are performed multiple times. So any small decrease in specificity becomes amplified for any particular patient. That's sort of the general two approaches. I think the data somewhat speaks to itself. We've published about 65, 70 papers with Signatera in the last few years. So the preponderance of evidence for solid tumor molecular residual disease testing is with the tumor-informed approaches. And I think in the future we may be non-tumor-informed, but right now I think that's where the field is.
And thank you. And a quick follow-up question. How do you view methylation-based assessments that are emerging?
Right. So methylation sort of fits in that category of tumor-naive approaches. We've seen a lot of those approaches being used for early cancer detection. At Natera, we also have worked in that space as well. I think the key that is kind of non-sexy work is you need to use a lot of samples to train to identify that methylation signature. You're looking for signatures at that point. So there needs to be a lot of work in getting large cohorts that allow you to define those algorithms that have that high sensitivity and specificity and are also not susceptible to comorbidities. And you see that a lot in the early cancer detection space where colitis, for instance, will confound the results. So those promising technology requires a lot of upfront years of work before you get into really being able to show the analytical aspects of that assay.
Thank you. So Jeff, excellent presentation this afternoon. And to build off your presentation and to build off the foundation that John just set, can you talk us through some of the different clinical contexts of use for ctDNA in a general sense? I know you reviewed a number of them earlier, and obviously this came up in your horizon scanning efforts at the Friends of Cancer Research. And so which of these areas have you also prioritized and think have had the most potential impact for patients?
Yeah, I think it's very wide-ranging, and there are probably different levels of evidence supporting the different use cases for circulating tumor DNA, which can really kind of span the entirety of kind of the cancer paradigm, as you mentioned, from early detection diagnoses, perhaps, all the way to looking at clonal changes and late stages of disease, and a little bit of everything in between, informing clinical trials, both in terms of a clinical endpoint or even for patient selection for subsetting patients that may have a different prognosis or response to therapy. All of these things, I think, hold potential that can be measured through the DNA fragments in the blood. Where we have put our focus is on the measure of response, whether it can be an indicator of response to various different therapies, and that may vary by tumor type and by drug class as well. The main interest that we've had in here is, again, there can be numerous use cases here. You mentioned using it internally for go, no-go decisions, which I think is relatively commonplace. If it is providing sufficient evidence to make a significant decision internally, is there also the possibility that it could lead to significant decisions externally, such as, verifying the efficacy of a drug? Not as much experience or perhaps enough evidence there, and that's where we thought a group like ours could help provide some of that foundational evidence. FDA has come out with guidance documents that describe that they would favor meta-analyses in order to support the validation of any new intermediate endpoint. For any one organization to undertake that would be quite an endeavor, both in terms of resources and times. And I'm not sure even some of the biggest companies would be able to aggregate that level of data across their portfolio alone. So I hope that perhaps one role of the nonprofit sector is to facilitate those pre-competitive types of collaborations in order to provide that foundational evidence, to explore the methodologies, to identify both the opportunities and the challenges that exist and with today's technology, and hopefully set the stage for what's to come in order to complete that journey faster should the evidence support the utilization of ctDNA change as a viable endpoint?
I think a lot of the radiologists here might be in a parallel session, so this might be a safe but controversial question, but do you think resist, the days are numbered for resist, and do you think innovative technologies such as the use of ctDNA are eventually going to take its place, or do you think, in fact, they would come together in some way to complement each other?
Yeah, I mean, if the days are numbered, I think the numbers are high. I don't think we'll see radiologic imaging go anywhere anytime soon. If for no other reason, people are quite comfortable with it, and it's a relatively accessible technology. You know, changing that, I think, would be a sea change. And that's not really the goal of the project that we're working on. Any early endpoint is going to be supported by the long-term evidence, whether that be RECIST measurement or the long-term clinical outcomes that one would want to see in order to fully validate an endpoint. And I think in our context, we're still exploring the extent to which a molecular response can be obtained earlier than a radiographic response, and that's going to vary by the setting as well. You know, when you look in the advanced disease setting, for example, that delta between the molecular response and the radiological response may not be a huge difference. But you know, when you think about where oncology is heading, and there's been plenty of discussions over the last couple of years around the movement of effective therapies into earlier lines of treatment. Perhaps as somewhat of a victim of success, those trials in the earlier disease or frontline settings become very long in order to complete. And so could there be a role for earlier endpoints to support drug development in a earlier, arguably in a setting where it can be more effective, more beneficial, but the investment in order to study drugs in that setting is significant. So there really is a need to have an earlier indicator of success in order to determine should we continue this study or discontinue.
Yeah, I think that's critical. Don't mean those timelines become untenable in the early setting, but it's critically important that we can go there and develop drugs in that space. So a common question that comes up whenever talking about these applications relates to regulatory considerations. So Reshram, I'm wondering if you could talk us through some of the typical guidance that you provide when it comes to the use of ctDNA or MRD in terms of both technology platforms and ensuring that the tests that you're using are robust, but then also considerations for trial design and the clinical trial itself that you're implementing this technology in.
So it really starts at the very first in-human study. When you're discussing the study design, because you have a part one and a part two, the dose escalation and dose expansion, you look at whether, obviously it's in the dose expansion, you want to include it as an exploratory endpoint. With both MRD, I think MRD in myeloma is a lot further ahead, but in terms of myeloid and in terms of lymphoma, it's still very early days. So you have to think about if you're including it even in your expansion phase of your phase one study. For TR, what's really going to be important is the vendor. You have to choose the right vendor that has the right assay. But if you were to then move forward into, if the asset was got to proof of concept and you went into larger studies, that's when the question is around the assay. You have to have a validated assay to actually then include it as a secondary endpoint. But so you've done it in your exploratory phase. Your long-term, your bigger studies, you have to have it as a secondary endpoint to enable. That's probably the first stage of can you have it as a label-enabling endpoint. So that's in your clinical section of the label. But in terms of surrogacy, not one company can do that. You have to do that in partnership with your competitors. You just can't do surrogacy work as a single company. So there is a lot in terms of just including it in your study because it becomes a discussion within the team as what the vendor, how much it's going to cost, how much samples are going to cost. You then talk about, because you then have to go through the various governance processes within your organization of whether they will support this vendor, the sampling, the cost of everything else that goes with it. So there is the budget side that you talk about as well. So it's not an easy process for any team to go. And I think one company can't do it. You've got to have an initiative that's out there that's helping you move forward, because I would say in the myeloma space, J&J were very successful with including MRD in their first in daratumumab studies. They started that quite early on. They had the discussions with the FDA at phase one and started to introduce MRD as an exploratory endpoint, worked with the vendor, ensured that the vendor was then validated, that we used MRDs in our phase three studies versus the secondary endpoint to ensure that we got it into our label. And then as we're moving forward, I mean, there's obviously other initiatives that are ongoing. We are looking at, you know, we've had a number of discussions with the FDA and the regulators whether we could use MRD as a primary endpoint, but each time we've been told no. And so we've moved it out to a secondary endpoint, but there is still this desire that we would love to have MRD as a primary endpoint, because once you get into the frontline settings, you're never going to get your drug approved because you're waiting for PFS. And if PFS for in the myeloma setting can take anything up to 8 years to read out, so those studies would be extremely long. So for any pharma company that's in the myeloma space, MRD would be a really good endpoint to have as the early clinical endpoint to have your novel agents again approved in that frontline setting.
And are there technological considerations for consolidating these data sets to enable the FDA to get on board with your proposal?
Yeah, so for myeloma, there's two initiatives. There's the I2 initiative and there's the Ola Langren initiative. Both of them, I think Jeff mentioned it, you have to do a meta-analysis, and this would be on retrospective randomized control studies. That's an expectation from FDA that there have to be randomized control studies. Methodology has to be validated. FDA is agnostic to methodology as long as it's validated assay. And I think in myeloma, you do have a validated assay. The issue becomes when you're combining pharma data with academic data as well. So in the myeloma space, the academic data, a lot of it comes from Europe. It's using flow, which is not a validated methodology. So you have to show concordance between the data as well. So that's the requirement. FDA require a large number of randomized control studies. And they have a very high statistical hurdle of R squared or 0.8 to meet. So you have to have trial levels, surrogacy, as well as patient level. And in terms of methodology, you know, in the myeloma space, you can get to 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. And when you mix data sets, which in the early days, it was 10 to the minus 4, it doesn't work. You don't reach that. And in the myeloma space, again, there's so many randomized studies, but you still can't reach that 0.8, that FDA, the hurdle FDA has put there for you. So it's tough. It's nearly a decade, I would say, that these initiatives have been ongoing, and we're still not there. And then it's the same in the myeloid space. I mean, if FDA are requesting a large number of randomized control studies, you're never going to get that. There's a high failure rate. So, again, we'll see. I mean, I'm hoping, you know, we'll get there at some point with the FDA. But methodology is going to be key for any disease setting you go for.
Yeah, and one last follow-up question there. Are there any learnings from the heme space that could be applied to the solid tumor space to help jumpstart there? Or perhaps another way to say it, any pitfalls to avoid, lessons learned that we could sort of go in a different direction?
Collaboration. You have to collaborate. You know, as pharma companies, you have to come together. You've got to put your expertise, your data, your knowledge, and also it's collaboration with academia. It's not just pharma companies, it's academia. But it's also bringing the regulators along with you on the journey. It's educating them, because I can tell you when we started the discussions with FDA, they were so conservative. It's taken a long time for them to soften. But here I'm talking about the FDA, but in parallel, you do need to think about Europe as well, and bringing the European agency along with you. So in parallel, it's always worth having the discussions. You know, as you are discussing with the FDA, discuss with EMA. But then the bigger hurdle also in Europe is that if you get the regulatory approval of a drug, will you get it to patients? Because you've got the whole aspect of market access and speaking to the HTAs. So again, one of the lessons is you need to bring the HTAs along with you, and you need patient advocacy groups with you to help you get through that process. So it's never a short process, and I would say it will take a good few years to get to, well, I hope we get there soon.
With that in mind, and the collaborative effort that's going to be required, and the importance of consortia and groups like the Friends of Cancer Research, Jeff, an opportunity to sort of broadcast, what would be helpful for you to enable these efforts? Are there particular data collection, particular types of studies? What would be helpful for you to help the community push this forward?
Yeah, well, I certainly, I think we've seen that level of collaboration in launching the project that we've been working on. You know, at this point, we have data that's coming from a dozen different pharmaceutical companies, almost two dozen trials that have been, you know, essentially donated to this work at a patient level. You know, so it's a significant commitment that the companies have put forward here, and a lot of trust in terms of, you know, how that data would be managed, and a lot of participation. You know, anyone who's put data in is part of the groups that have written the protocols and the analysis plans. So hopefully it's a learning opportunity for everyone, including the regulators that have been participating in the study designs as well. You know, moving forward, you know, we are at a point where at least, you know, most of the modules that we've been constructing here are underway. The data is being submitted to our independent analysis center, or the analyses have been completed in some cases. So it's not really an issue of just, you know, donating the data at this point. Where I do think there's opportunity is, you know, how do we implement what we're learning at this point? And I think that will require some degree of transparency as well. Because what I would love to see is that we start coming away with, you know, the positive signals that we're seeing in terms of ctDNA correlating with long-term outcomes. But now we need to think about how to embed this into future studies. You know, what are the appropriate indications to be going after here? How can there be continued collaboration around what those parameters look like? You know, what we've seen, you know, from data sets that were not constructed in a collaborative manner is you have a host of things like, you know, different assays that were used, different time points for their collection, different methodologies. And that's going to have to continue, right? There's always going to be that degree of flexibility that's going to be needed. But I think in order to be successful, there is going to have to be some strategic thinking. And this will, again, I think, push up against the barriers of competition a little bit about how much you're willing to share about your study design before those studies are getting going. But in order to be successful in, you know, prospectively planning across a number of different trials to show that this is a real biological and clinical phenomena is going to require continued coordination beyond just this evidence foundation that I think we will get to a point with in the next several months, but most importantly is going to be operationalizing the findings.
Makes sense. Subtle change of gears. All relates to evidence generation ultimately, but John, we were speaking a bit yesterday about ctDNA-based stratification, and we talked about the Circulate study very briefly. Could you dive in a bit deeper here, give a little context, a little background into the Circulate study, which I think is going to be really impactful?
Yeah, so this is a study. There's actually multiple Circulates, but the one that is probably the largest is Circulate Japan, and it has a couple of different arms within it. So this is a study in stage 2 and 3 CRC that is using Signatera as an assay, first in a registry-type fashion, so following observationally patients without using the ctDNA to guide whether they receive adjuvant chemotherapy or not. But then also, there are arms of it where there is escalation of patients who are ctDNA positive after surgery to receive chemo and, in some instances, another investigational therapy. And in another arm of the study, there's a de-escalation arm. So patients who are ctDNA negative, they forego adjuvant treatment until they become ctDNA positive. And if they never become ctDNA positive, they never get adjuvant treated. We know that that's a setting. CRC is a really good kind of test case because we know it's a setting where we're over-treating a lot of patients with adjuvant chemo, a standard of care. So there's that opportunity to de-escalate. But then we know that there's still a decent portion of patients who have surgery, curative intent surgery, have adjuvant chemotherapy, and still go on to recur. So there's actually two opportunities there to really guide therapy with ctDNA. In the U.S., there's a similar type study that focuses on the de-escalation arm. And so that I think the Circulate Japan study has enrolled close to 3,000 patients and will have, has had several readouts on the observational side, and will have, hopefully in the next year, a readout on the interventional arm. So I think that's really the first opportunity where we see really at a phase 3 stage a readout of ctDNA-guided care in CRC.
That's going to be an amazing data set. Large data set, that's incredible. So two more questions, and then maybe we can open up to the audience if there's time, and I'll lob this out to the panel here. We're at the Immuno-Oncology 360 Summit, so I wanted to ask an IO-specific question here. Are there any specific considerations for immuno-oncology applications of circulating tumor DNA assessments? I know as part of your study, you started with PD-1, then moved to TKIs, and now you're circling back again. But I'd love to hear any thoughts on IO-specific considerations from all on the panel.
Jeff, can I go first?
I think maybe one obvious one is, you know, there have certainly been experiences in different tumor types treated with IO of the conundrum of interpreting potential for pseudoprogression. I don't know if we'll see that same phenomena from molecular response, but, it doesn't appear to be. So it could help sort that out. Another area that we've seen some preliminary indication that could be beneficial is in the stable disease setting, which is a bit of a clinical challenge of how to manage those patients. But we have some preliminary data that's indicated that for patients with stable disease, you can differentiate between their molecular response, and that correlates with long-term outcomes. So there is the potential, I think, for ctDNA monitoring to help inform treatment decisions associated with patients that are in sort of that gray zone of stable disease.
Yeah, and I think in our experience, we've had an interesting experience with immune checkpoint inhibitors with the Signatera assay, and it's actually a covered indication by Medicare. So some early observations and some nice publications looking at monotherapy immune checkpoint checkpoint inhibitor treatment, where you see early ctDNA clearance. So patient was positive to start, they go on 1, 2, 3 cycles of an ICI. If they cleared their ctDNA, those patients, what we have seen, almost uniformly experience very long overall survival, you know, improved PFS, et cetera, et cetera. You see that middle zone, so when we're talking about the stable disease by RECIST, you see that middle zone of patients who decrease, but they don't clear, and those patients you have to watch closer, maybe add in an IO combination. All those things are still investigational. But there's a set of patients, especially on monotherapy, who their ctDNA goes up in those early cycles of checkpoint inhibitors. And those patients do very, very poorly. And there's this great opportunity to design interventional studies for molecular progressors on IO, and encourage anyone in this room to do those studies, because you have this window of opportunity to get in there for patients who are resistant to checkpoint inhibitors from the very get-go. And you've got an opportunity to intervene and change that. And we see, because clinicians in the community use our ask, in any given month, 35% of U.S. practicing oncologists order a Signatera test. The community uses these technologies, and a big use of that is immune therapy monitoring. And what you see is there's, in tumor types where there are multiple approvals of standard of care, single agent monotherapy, ICI versus two immunotherapies, or an IO chemo combo, something like that. And you see and hear that the community are making those types of decisions for those patients who progress that are really, really, I think, unmet need and elegant opportunity for doing investigational therapy work. Screening is a little bit different than what you might typically do, but a nice window of opportunity to get in there and not be so far in that late line that, you know, drug developers often complain about having to start, you know, so many lines of therapy on. This is an opportunity to get in much earlier.
Reshma, any comment?
Well, from a pharma perspective, ctDNA could be used much early on to determine if you drop a product, an asset, or you continue with an asset, or it could be used for patient stratification in your studies as well. So I think there's a lot of utility on ctDNA, definitely.
Yeah, and the observations around molecular response to parse out stable disease patients is really important, obviously, in the real-world setting, but in clinical trials. Every program team thinks they're going to land in a crystal-clear go zone or no-go zone, but we often end up in that gray space. And having a tool to help us parse the difference between the different stable disease patients to build confidence to move a program forward, to make a confident no-go, is so valuable, and building on that is critically important. We have 2.5 minutes left, so we actually are running out of time really quickly. So maybe we can close with a forward-looking question to the panel, and we can start here and work our way down. And it's a very simple one. Where will we be in the ctDNA space in the year 2030, which is coming up fast, actually?
I'm an optimist. I think that we, by that time, I'm hopeful that we will have seen clinical development programs that made the investment to power their trials and invest in the utilization of ctDNA as a viable endpoint. And I hope that whoever chooses to make that decision aligns it with a highly effective drug product, and because magnitude matters. And so, should a undeniable change in ctDNA accompany clinical outcomes, I think that will be very persuasive for what happens in 2031.
For me, I would like to see MRD accepted by FDA as an early clinical endpoint for accelerated approval, and also for them to amend their guidance around MRD.
I think I feel very confident in saying that we will have FDA approvals based on ctDNA-enriched adjuvant population, so there will be solid tumors for which there is ctDNA-guided care in for adjuvant therapies of various kinds. I think that is rather certain. I think we will by then. I think there will be a test case and enough data to see at least an accelerated approval by 2030 in the solid tumor space. I think the interesting thing, and I've always appreciated this point from different academic groups, but certainly the work that Friends has done, even in cohorts where you have very diverse assay modalities and outputs, the directionality always stays the same. The sensitivity assay can affect the hazard ratio, but the directionality stays the same. The biology is robust. You just need to have the technologies, which I think are largely here, to capture it. And then the framework and the wherewithal to incorporate it early and often to drive that advancement that we're looking for.
Perfect. Thank you. And with that, we promised we'd stick the landing at exactly 40 minutes. It's 40 minutes and 20 seconds at this point. I think we did a pretty good job. So in summary, let's collaborate. I think collaboration is going to be the key to moving the field forward. So let's all plan to do just that. I want to thank the panelists for the fantastic discussion. That was really outstanding. And thank you to the audience for your attention.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For more information on the IO360 conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, you can visit io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thank you for listening.